recuse Judge Bishop, Judge Rico Bishop of Lincoln will take my place, and Chief Judge Frankie Moore will take over as presiding judge.
Thank you. Please be seated and you may approach. When you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jared Olson. I'm an attorney for the appellant, Mr. Harmon. In our brief, we raised several errors that we believe are both reversible and highly prejudicial against our client, but I want to focus on the three most, what we think are the most egregious ones today. First, that the county court erred by denying our motion for directed verdict and ruling on this despite the fact that appellee failed to meet even a prima facie burden of proof. Second, that the court, in making its judgment, relied on items that were not in evidence and in some cases were barred from evidence. And third, that the county court lacked jurisdiction because a necessary party was not part of this action and was not present at the trial. On the issue of the proof, the original complaint in county court raised three issues of damages that Ms. Van Lanningham believed should have been disclosed by Mr. Harmon. That is, there is a leak in the around a window, a leak in the basement of the property, and alleged structural damage resulting from a prior explosion in the garage. However, at the time of trial, Ms. Van Lanningham and her expert both testified that this explosion was fully repaired, there was no structural damage, and that claim was dismissed. The only two issues remaining at bar were the leaks. Under the Nebraska Revised Statute 76-21-20, the statute requiring disclosures in real estate, the seller need only disclose items known by the seller on the date of disclosure. And it goes on to state that this is not a warranty, this does not take the place of an inspection, it's simply what you know on that date. Therefore, Ms. Van Lanningham has the burden to prove that these leaks even existed prior to the sale and that Mr. Harmon had knowledge of the leaks and failed to disclose them.
And can circumstantial evidence be sufficient to sustain that burden?
Circumstantial evidence, yes, can be sufficient, but there still needs to be a showing that there actually was a leak, and you cannot really rely on inferences. In the case of Richardson v. Ames Corp., as cited in our brief, the court has said plaintiffs do not sustain their position by reliance alone on inferences, which would entitle them to recovery.
But didn't Van Lanningham's expert testify or have a report indicating that it had been years since the damage had been occurring?
There was also contradicting testimony from Mr. Harmon, and even if the leak had existed prior to the sale, nothing in that expert testimony or any other testimony evidence offered showed that Mr. Harmon had any knowledge of these leaks.
How does one prove that knowledge? Doesn't this come down to the credibility of the witnesses, and didn't the county court judge make a specific point regarding credibility in her order?
She did, and I will actually be touching on that more because I believe the court relied on certain inadmissible items for that credibility. However, insofar as the evidence showed, and even Ms. Van Lanningham admitted at trial that she lacked evidence, I think that the credibility issue is a far less issue. On cross-examination, Ms. Van Lanningham was asked, question, and you have no evidence that the windows leaked when Mr. Harmon lived in the house, isn't that true? And she answered, I have no evidence, no. At the point where she's admitted she has no evidence that these even leaked prior to the sale, let alone that Mr. Harmon had knowledge of the leaks, I think that she's failing to meet even a prima facie burden.
So is the expectation that she has to go and subpoena and depose every window repairman in the area?
Well, the burden of proof on this kind of claim is high because, again, the purpose of these disclosures was made very clear in the statute. This isn't a warranty. In fact, Mr. Harmon offered to purchase a homeowner's warranty and offered to pay for professional inspection, both of which were declined by Ms. Van Lanningham at the time of sale. This disclosure is not meant to take the place of that. Ms. Van Lanningham had opportunity to inspect the property, had opportunity to walk through it. It is not Mr. Harmon's duty or responsibility to warrant that there's nothing wrong with the house. He's simply saying, I'm not aware of any issues at this time. And I think that is what, to put anything further on a property puts an insufferable burden on any real estate transaction saying that if I'm selling my house, I have to guarantee that there's absolutely no cracks or leaks anywhere in the entire house.
Wasn't the county judge troubled, though, that he failed to disclose the explosion in the garage that occurred in 2003, but he did admit to some hail damage years later in 2006 or 7? And that was troubling to the judge in terms of credibility.
The judge did rely on that, and I guess I'll address that right now, in that Mr. Harmon did inadvertently fail to disclose that. He forgot about that issue at the time. However,
an explosion, right?
Yeah, there was an explosion prior to the issue. However, as we stated, the record shows that Ms. Van Lanningham's own expert and the other experts from Mr. Harmon both testified that that explosion was completely repaired. That is completely unrelated to these leaks in the house. It is irrelevant to this issue, and it wasn't a felony charge. It wasn't anything regarding dishonesty. He pled guilty to that issue prior. And in fact,
does the disclosure statute say as long as you repair things properly, you do not need to disclose the damage?
No. But again, none of the damages being claimed in this action had anything in relation to that explosion. Even though Mr. Harmon failed to disclose that explosion, the evidence in the record shows that it's completely irrelevant to this matter. If it had caused the leaks, that would be a separate issue, but there is no evidence to show it was any way related to this issue, so it is irrelevant as far as the court's concerned. Furthermore, the court's reliance on this prior guilty plea regarding the explosion is one of our second errors here, in that it was completely inappropriate, we believe, and another reversible error. This guilty plea was never offered into evidence by any of the parties, and in fact, at a pretrial conference, the county court judge ordered in limine that no mention of this, of the police report or the criminal proceedings, could even be discussed at trial because it was far too prejudicial. So for the court to say, you can't talk about this at trial, and then to turn around and say, well, we believe this is very compelling, creates a double standard and basically undercuts what is actually the foundation of evidence. The court, we believe, erred also when it relied on affidavit testimony of John Walker, which it cited to in its order. Now, Mr. Walker's affidavit was never offered into evidence, authenticated, or accepted as evidence in this. It's not in the record anywhere. Mr. Walker never appeared to testify. He was never able to be cross-examined. But the court, in its final order, listed his affidavit testimony, out-of-state hearsay, out-of-court hearsay, as one of its most compelling and, quote, specifically compelling pieces of evidence that it relied upon. And we think, again, insofar as we are guided by the rules of evidence, for a court to rely on items that were never discussed at trial, were never addressed, and never even part of the record, I think, is clear error. And
if we were to agree with you on that point, isn't there enough other evidence that would have been sufficient for the judge to have reached this ruling?
Well, we really have no way to know that, which is part of the reason why we requested a motion for a new trial and asked that the court offer a new trial where we could actually weigh all the evidence once it's been properly offered and authenticated. But the court refused to even try to hold a new trial with actual evidence.
Mr. Olson,
insofar as the courts relied on at least two, we know of at least two items that were relied on outside the record, we think that that's just clear prejudicial error. I apologize.
And I don't believe you raised this in your brief, but in looking at that paragraph of the court's order, it also references Exhibits 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 as being relied upon, and I don't find those anywhere in the record.
Yes, I believe those were, I don't have time to address them right here today, but they were addressed in either our opening brief or a reply brief, that there were additional exhibits beyond these two. We believe these are the most compelling. But there were additional exhibits that were cited to in the court's order that were simply never part of the record. And insofar as we don't know what the court was ruling on, and we know for a fact that it relied on items that were never supposed to be mentioned at all, we think that's just simply a prima facie showing of a reversible error. Finally, though, even the simplest way we can really review this, if you're looking at this, is that the court lacked jurisdiction at the time of trial to even rule on this matter. And Mary Lou Harmon, Mr. Harmon's wife, was also co-owner of the house. She helped with the sale. She helped with the disclosures. And the appellees did not originally join her in this action, but they attempted to join her later, filing a, quote, motion to join a necessary party in April 2013. In that motion, they judicially admitted that she was a necessary party and that this could not be resolved without her being present or without determining her rights.
She became a party at that point, didn't she?
They attempted to, but by the time they tried to join her as a party, the statute of limitations had run and she was dismissed by no fault or action of Mr. Harmon's. So the fact that she was not present at the time of the trial, and the court, we believe, also lacked jurisdiction to rule on this.
I thought she was present at the time of trial. I thought she testified.
She was no longer, well, she was offered as a witness, but she was not a party to this action at the time. And under the rules, the courts have said that the presence of necessary parties is jurisdictional and cannot be waived by the parties. That was Pestle v. Malone.
But she was added as a party and later dismissed on her motion.
She was dismissed on her own motion because she was not brought in within the statute of limitations. So we believe that
we don't know that from the order, do we? Why she was dismissed.
I believe that was the basis for the order. I would have to look again at that. But we believe each of these three errors, along with the other ones identified in our brief, provide independent reasons to reverse this order. And for that reason, we respectfully request that this item, that the lower courts be reversed, and that our motion for directed verdict be granted, or at the minimum, that we be sent remanded for a new trial where actual evidence is relied upon and offered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Brian Caldwell for the appellee, Jennifer Van Lanningham. I just wanted to address a couple of the things that opposing counsel mentioned. The first was with regards to the directed verdict. As the court had mentioned, that one of the issues that we can use in order to determine whether the evidence is sufficient is the credibility of the witnesses. And the court did take compelling notice that Mr. Harmon lacked credibility. He mentioned he testified to having included information with regards to an insurance claim for hail damage, but did not include a similar insurance claim for a firework damage to the house as well.
Would you mind addressing the exhibits that the judge referenced in her order that were not actually received in evidence, as well as the affidavit?
Okay, yes. And I'll just kind of, I believe that the exhibits that were not in evidence that were referenced by the court, the first one being the information about Mr. Harmon's criminal past. It's listed in one sentence. It's a standalone a sentence that doesn't really indicate what the court is determining from that sentence.
It's one of two sentences in its order discussing credibility. How do we ignore that?
I think that the court, in its order, did mention that the inconsistent statements were the most compelling for the lack of credibility of Mr. Harmon. And I don't believe it said at all whether his criminal past was compelling. I think it was just listed as he had a criminal past. And we know that it shouldn't have been reviewed or even mentioned. But we don't believe that is a reversible error.
And the judge on the motion for rehearing did acknowledge that there was an incorrect reference to some of those exhibits.
That's correct. And
but I can't recall. I kind of scanned the transcript to see if I could find it. I couldn't see where it was, where there was actually an amendment to the first order.
There wasn't one, Your Honor. And then going off on the affidavit of Mr. Walker. Again, that wasn't something that was offered by my client or anybody. Again, the court has said, the Supreme Court has said that if there's other relevant information evidence that was properly admitted and it details similar facts or similar testimony, then it's not an error to.
Is there a problem that the affidavit isn't in our record? We don't even know what it says, so we don't know what the judge is relying upon.
And again, I think from the testimony that Mr. Ellers, the expert structural engineer, the court did mention several times that his testimony from his deposition and his report were the most compelling with regards to the damage, the long-term damage that had been happening at the house, once the drywall was removed from the basement, there was new lumber indicating a repair had been done recently. We just don't believe that, let me rephrase, We believe that the properly admitted evidence that the court mentioned in its order from Mr. Ehlers is more compelling, and if there was some sort of reference to Mr. Walker's affidavit, it's not necessarily something that would override Mr. Ehlers' deposition.
Mr. Caldwell, so there was a hearing on the motion for new trial at which the county court judge acknowledged referring to some evidence that had not been admitted, correct? But there was no subsequent modification of the original order. Is it your position that we can rely on the judge's statements at the motion for new trial hearing in terms of her findings and kind of a modification of her findings without her actually putting it into a new order?
You know, I don't have any case law that would back that up, but I would make the argument that yes, it's as part of the transcript, and it would be the court's thoughts and phrasing of the issues.
Because in essence, that was where she was just explaining the mistake, but still saying there was other evidence that she relied on.
And I think you could go to the fact that in the court's court's theory would be that it doesn't matter. There was so much overwhelming evidence that it didn't matter. We don't need to change this. Already plenty of evidence that would come with the same conclusion.
But the court went on in that order, the discussion in ruling on the motion for new trial, that there were still 10 other exhibits that were taken into consideration when making this determination. 5 of those exhibits are not in the record. Is that a problem? And I don't want to talk about those exhibits because they're not in the record, she's saying, I made these 2 mistakes, but there's still this other evidence, but half of the exhibits are not in evidence.
I wasn't trial counsel, so I don't even know what those exhibits are.
Okay, well, then we don't want to talk about it either.
Not knowing what they are, I don't know whether they're even relevant to the issues. I believe that the issues are just the credibility of the witnesses, the evidence that Ms. Van Lanningham submitted along with Mr. Ehlers' deposition and report, were all the compelling factors of the facts that the court reviewed. The last thing I just wanted to address was opposing counsel's contests or belief that the court did not have jurisdiction because Ms. Harmon, Mary Lou Harmon, was not included as a necessary party. It's my argument. I don't believe that I did a very good job of explaining my argument in the brief, so I'm glad that I have an opportunity to more clarify it. The argument from Mr. Harmon is that by including language in our amended complaint and motion that Ms. Harmon was a necessary party is an admission and a pleading. And we don't believe that that's the case. We believe that's a legal conclusion for the court to determine. The Supreme Court has as lately as the Pestle v. Malone case, has said that a necessary party is one whose interest in the controversy is such that the controversy cannot be fully adjudicated without affecting that party's interest. In this situation, Ms. Harmon's interests would not have any issues whatsoever. She's not going to lose property. There's no that's going to be issued against her. There's no injunction for her to do or not do something. She was dismissed, and her interests were protected. So we don't believe that there is any issues with not including Ms. Harmon in the actual trial. Now, she was, as mentioned previously, she was added as a party and was later dismissed because of the statute of limitations. I believe that was something that the trial counsel did admit to, the plaintiff's trial counsel did admit to. But again, I don't believe that her interests were at all at issue, and she was not harmed by being dismissed. And Mr. Harmon was not even harmed by her being dismissed from the case. Because he cannot be liable for her actions, and he wasn't found liable of any of her actions with regards to the disclosure statement. Unless there was any other questions, I would just ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court and the county court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was Mr. Olson out of time? Okay. I was going to say, I thought it was close. Okay.
Oh.
1 second. We'll give you 5 seconds.
I got 5 seconds. This court has said in Griffith v. Drews, LLC, it is reversible error if a trial court relies on erroneously admitted evidence. That's what happened here. We ask for reversal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Off the record now, Mr. Olson, I don't see that you signed the sign-in sheet.
I think it had moved right before I showed up.